Thank you, Emily.
Plenty to unpack this morning after that incredible keynote. Thanks so much. I remember that first FEW where you joined us very well. At this point, I would like to invite some colleagues on to the stage. So if Brian Jennings and Jeff Cooper and John Feuer could join me on stage, I'd like to have a discussion and unpack some of the items that Emily laid out, some of the items that are certainly on the minds of everyone in this room. So, gentlemen. Good morning. I'm going to sit right here. There you go. Gentlemen.
How are you doing?
Thanks for joining me.
Sure.
Again, I want to thank Leaf for sponsoring the general session this morning, for making all of this possible. Lots to dive into. I think I said this to all of you last night. I've been an industry observer for a decade, and I feel like now I have the most difficult time explaining to people the state of play in our space. And I'm hoping you can help me unpack that this morning. So a couple of things. I've got a bank of questions here that my panelists are prepared to walk through with me. There's also microphones in the aisles. And so in about a half hour, we'll open up the microphones for questions. And so please prepare questions and have those questions ready, and we'll absolutely engage the audience in bringing them into this conversation. So the title of the panel promises that we'll try and understand what the state of biofuels policy is under the Trump administration. Certainly a lot of that characterized the keynote speech. And I'll just open it up with anybody that wants to take a stab at it. We've got a number of things to discuss. RVP relief, small refiner exemptions. So where do we start? John, why don't I throw it to you? Let's dive into the conversation. What would you place at the top of the list? What's most important for the audience to understand this morning?
I think the first thing that's really happened over the last 6 months has been this conversation with the Trump White House. And this is something that we haven't really had before. You have a president who, when he campaigned to be the president in Iowa during the Iowa caucuses, he made this a central issue of his campaign. And it was something he took a personal interest in then, and now he's taking a personal interest in it again. And I think he sees this as something where he could possibly be a deal maker. And so he's instructed his team to go out and try and find ways forward. And that's why we've had these number of meetings on this issue over the course of 6 months. You've had a couple things that have come up unrelated to this. When we look back at what the RVO process was in late 2018, that's kind of where this started. We started to hear about this notice of data availability. You started to hear about export RINs as an option. And so our champions engaged, and they said, we don't like this, hold up. And they got the president to commit to saying no to that, and they got the EPA administrator to say no as well in letter form. And then Ted Cruz came in, and he decided he wanted something on his end. And then it's kind of snowballed from there. So this is the thing that I think is the newest entrant into this discussion. We've always had a reform discussion. That's changed, I guess, a little bit over this year, but this is kind of the new entrant over the last 6 months has really been this White House interest. You've got people competing for attention within the administration, and they have different perspectives on this, but that to me is the new entrant into this over the last 6 months.
Got it. Jeff, I want to highlight something that you shared with our Ethanol 101 audience yesterday in your very good presentation. 16.7 billion gallons of installed capacity if this industry was at full throttle.
Right.
And then you understand the impact that these small refiner exemptions are having. So we've got the capacity there. These small refiner exemptions are a big, big deal. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely a big deal. And you heard the term demand destruction used earlier. That's a phrase that Secretary Perdue has been using to describe what's happening as a result of the small refiner exemptions. And even though EPA hasn't really clarified for the public just the extent of these exemptions and how much volume has been waived and who's been getting them, we've been able to piece together using some EPA data what we feel like is a pretty good estimate of the volume impacted, and it's somewhere north of 1.6 billion gallons has been exempted or waived from RFS compliance, and that's over the course of 2016 and 2017. And so, you know, the oil industry will say, well, that's in the past, so how could that be affecting demand today? And the answer is very simple. Those are RINs, those 1.6 billion RINs that were anticipated to be needed for compliance with those 2 years ended up not being needed for compliance. So they can roll forward and be used for compliance with future standards. And so we've got a huge stock of surplus RINs available that could be used in lieu of physical blending to comply with the 2018 standards. And certainly we're seeing that reflected in the week-to-week market data that we get from EIA. We're seeing softer demand domestically. If it weren't for the booming exports that we're seeing, I think margins that are pretty thin right now would be much worse off, because the domestic market is absolutely softening as a result of these small refinery exemptions.
And we're feeling it. The men and women in this room that operate ethanol plants are definitely feeling that softening market right now.
And just one more point. I mean, 1.6 billion gallons, you know, what is the impact of that? That's $2.5 billion worth of ethanol. That's 570 million bushels of corn, so, you know, another $2 billion worth of corn or so. You factor the RINs in, so we've estimated that's a $5 billion loss to the folks in this room, to the people in this industry through those small refiner exemptions.
Brian, on Friday my phone started blowing up that Administrator Pruitt was going to be making a whistle stop tour through the Midwest, including your hometown of Sioux Falls. Certainly, he's implicated in this. What do you know about Administrator Pruitt's agenda while he's around, and how can you characterize sort of his relationship with, again, the Trump administration's professed interest in protecting the RFS and sort of this impasse with $5 billion of lost economic activity because of these waivers?
We don't know a lot about what Administrator Pruitt is up to. We know that as we sit here right now in this room, he just completed a tour of East Kansas Agri Energy, a member of ACE and RFA, and he's convening a meeting right now, closed to the press meeting, with some of the investors of East Kansas Agri Energy and some farmers. The Kansas corn growers are part of that. We've been speaking with them. I think the farmers are prepared to ask the questions and make the comments that need to be made to the administrator. Tomorrow, he will be traveling to my home state of South Dakota. He will be doing a meeting with farmers in sort of the western part of the state, I think, to sort of take a bow for what he's doing with respect to removing regulations broadly and what he's doing with WOTUS. But we've been able to get some ethanol advocates invited to that closed meeting as well. And then tomorrow morning in Sioux Falls, the South Dakota Corn Growers Association, POET, Growth Energy, ACE, others are organizing a rally, sort of a small tractor rally, I guess, Tim, in Sioux Falls, to try and get some media attention, get some spotlight on the fact that, yes, the president has made a commitment to this industry through the campaign, through repeated promises in office now, but the divide between the promises that the president is making and the actions that the EPA administrator is taking is enormous. Not fulfilling the promise the president made to uphold the RFS as the law of the land because of the small refinery exemptions, namely. Not upholding the president's two promises to allow E15 use year-round. About 60 days ago, for the first time, President Trump sat in the cabinet room and he said, we're going to allow E15 use year-round. As Emily said in her keynote, we're now into the low RVP season, and in the conventional gasoline areas, retailers aren't supposed to offer that fuel to their customers unless it's for an FFV. And so what we're hoping to get out of this visit, I think, from the administrator is that he gets a little truth serum from rural America, from farmers. Frankly, he needs to get his ass chewed by ethanol advocates and farmers, and he needs to get back to D.C. and take on some of these actions that have been promised of us.
Absolutely. So in terms of the small refiner exemption, what's the remedy and relief there? Is just an executive order from Trump to say enough of this? Is it that straightforward? Is it that simple? And of course, who are the folks that are going to be in the administrator's ear on the other side?
Well, I think it's a couple things. I mean, first of all, you have to have an immediate stop to the shenanigans that are happening with the small refiner exemption right now. No more. We've got to stop waving through companies like Marathon and ExxonMobil and Endeavor. I mean, these are not small refiners, right? These are some of the largest, most profitable companies in the world. So that's stage one, is you got to stop this immediately. Stage two is we need some repair for the damage that's already been done. 1.6 billion gallons, $5 billion worth of economic losses. How do we get that back? So there's been some discussion on how would those gallons be reallocated to future RVOs. How do they make that up to us? And so I think that's a part of the conversation as well. We, along with ACE and the Corn Growers and National Farmers Union, have filed a lawsuit in the Tenth Circuit, going after two refiners in particular that received exemptions, and making the argument that those exemptions were given in error by EPA, and hopefully using this suit to really shine some light on this very secretive process and uncover some of what's really been going on behind closed doors at EPA. We've also filed a petition with many others in the biofuel and ag space for reconsideration with EPA that on a go-forward basis would have them revisit and change the way they do this process and kind of get back to the statutory intent of this exemption, as well as a suit in the D.C. Circuit Court. So we are, doing what we can through all means available to remedy this situation, but it's, damage has been done. We need some
solutions. If I could add to that just a moment, Tim, we don't litigate against the administration lightly. It's an expensive process. It's time consuming, particularly with these small refinery exemptions, because they're granted on an individual basis. So we can't take on all 25 or 30 of them. So the three examples that Jeff mentioned really sort of stand out as being egregious, but It takes time, and I know some people in the industry are sort of like, well, the remedy would be so far down the line. What is the value in this? And the value is making sure that a precedent is not set. When the law of the land is on your side, and the EPA in this case is absolutely turning its back on the law and doing what it wants to anyway, we have to stand up for ourselves because of a precedent like this is set, where so much volume is supposed to be used, but EPA can turn the other way and say, we're ignoring that and we're going to do something else. If we want octane to be the demand driver for us in the future, if we want E25 or E30 to be the way we grow the market in the future, and there's a policy mechanism whereby that is sort of underpinned, if we allow this precedent to stand, where EPA allows obligated parties to escape their responsibility to blend ethanol, it will set a bad precedent in the future where maybe obligated parties, refiners, whoever, don't have to follow the law when it comes to an E25 or an E30. So it's really important that we stand up for ourselves in court when we have the opportunity and that we win.
If I could add one more thing.
Absolutely,
onto that,
John.
I think Brian raises a very good point about a precedent. And if you look back to the last administration, I want to talk about something that happened with them where they tried to say, we're gonna introduce a supply waiver. We're gonna redefine supply as demand, and we're gonna allow the RFS to be reduced by just doing it that way. Right now, we've had for the last several years 15 billion gallons of conventional ethanol available under the RFS, and it's because this industry joined together, filed a lawsuit, worked through the courts, and we got that stricken in the courts. We need to do the same thing here. We need to go through the legal process, and we need to go through whatever avenues are available to do this, so when we get to a year or two down the line, we can impact this process so we don't have to deal with this anymore. What EPA is doing is outright egregious, and they have definitely destroyed demand. And so we have passed history that we have done as an industry to show that this type of action can be very impactful and can be very effective for people who produce ethanol.
Got it. I want to talk a little bit about E15 and RVP. Again, I'm going to tie in some of your comments yesterday, Jeff. It was interesting. There was a pie chart that talked about ethanol production. 90% of that typically goes into an E10 blend. About 9% of it's an export market. And then now, for now, a very small sliver for E15 sales. But clearly, this is a critical piece of the puzzle.
Absolutely.
And obviously, as you said yesterday, well, in a perfect world, it's half the demand we currently have that could be added, so maybe another 7 billion gallons. But this summertime RVP season that we all, people in this room, know about and talk about, is there a chance that we could have relief yet this season? Is it the kind of thing that Trump could say, hey, RVP, the waiver is lifted now, or is it we kick the can down the road to next season? And then, and this is for everybody, because I know you all have relationships with retailers, which we learned a lot about yesterday. This really is a stop point for fuel retailers to introduce E15. So let's first talk about the sort of importance of getting this vapor pressure thing figured out, our chances to get it figured out maybe this season, and then we can move the conversation from there.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'll start. Certainly EPA Administrator Pruitt does have the administrative authority to do emergency fuel waivers and emergency rules, direct final rules. So technically, could the RVP issue be fixed, in a matter of weeks? Yes, technically it could. Do we see it playing out that way? I don't think so. I think all indications are that they would be pursuing a more conventional kind of notice and comment rulemaking process, and if that started tomorrow, after public comments and OMB interagency review and that whole process, and then a final rule, I mean, you're looking at a minimum of 90 to 120 days before you would have a final rule. Well, that's, we're well into fall by that time, and so you're looking at next year realistically as the time frame to solve this. Absolutely agree with the points that have been made that is far and away the single largest barrier to expanded ethanol consumption in the U.S. Every retailer that we talk to that hasn't taken the plunge into E15, that's, if not the top concern, it's among the top three that they have is the RVP, the relabeling. What do I do in the summertime? I don't, if I can't sell a product year-round, I'm not going to mess with it. So absolutely needs to be alleviated. Once we get that problem solved, yeah, I think we could see fairly rapid expansion in E15. Will it be 7 billion gallons of new ethanol demand in 5 years? No, I don't think it will be. I mean, let's not forget it took us 30, 35 years to get E10 saturation nationwide. These things take time. And one other point, I mean, we've got, the largest gasoline-consuming states, California, New York, where you can't sell E15 today at all, not just in the summertime, period. So 18% of the market can't sell E15 if they wanted to, even in the non-summer months. So there are some challenges that we are absolutely trying to work through, but a top priority for us, and I know the others as well.
Go ahead, Brian.
I would add, it's fixing reed vapor pressure relief for E15 is not any longer a question of whether it's good policy with an EPA. Previously, career bureaucrats at EPA would hold this up, and under President Obama, they said, okay, we're not going to move forward. A refreshing change under this administration is that, yes, the political appointees understand that the law can be interpreted differently to enable this. It's not a policy question. It's what legal avenue are you going to take, and then do you have the political willpower to do it? I mean, let's be honest right now. RVP relief for E15 is being held hostage politically by Scott Pruitt, because he wants to find yet another win for refiners before he does it. You've got his boss, the president, saying twice, let's get it done. So part of that trip that we talked about a moment ago hopefully inspires, if that's the right word, Scott Pruitt to go back to Washington and to do the right thing. E15 relief, RVP relief, E15 sales year-round in and of itself isn't going to be a silver bullet, and I think everyone appreciates that, but sometimes we want something to happen so bad we sort of hold it up on this pedestal and say, that's the only thing, and everything else will be okay. Remember, in RFG areas today, E15 can be sold year-round, and it's not by all of the retailers because maybe there's a franchise prohibition. An oil refiner, a branded supplier says, you can't sell E15 at your station. So make no mistake, getting RVP relief is a big deal, but we will have additional work to do in order to get the sort of market growth we want.
John, I know on your notes you identified E15 in some of those states that Jeff mentioned. What's the remedy for those states that it's currently illegal to sell E15, and are we at work on those states? Those are big, big markets, 18%, as Jeff said.
You know, if you look at the states where it's currently not legal, there's about a handful of them around the country. I know there's a lot of work being done by Growth, ACE, RFA, others in California to try and find a way to get to 15% that will be allowable by the California Resources Board. New York, there's been work that's been done over a number of years. You know, at one point in time, we thought this would be something we could get done relatively easily, and then ExxonMobil, because they had a dispute with the Attorney General in the state at the time, decided to weigh in there and try and make that process more difficult. And then you've got other states where you've just got prohibitions, either they're driven by regulation or they're driven by some sort of statutory item, whether it's a percent of oxygen that can be in fuel. And those are some states where we're also working on this too. But, you know, you take the two big ones outside of, you know, you get New York and California. The other ones are relatively smaller markets. Those are the real big ones, and there's a lot of work happening in those two states to open them up. But, you know, you've got to work through the bureaucratic morass in those states to get it done. And it takes some time. And, you know, luckily, we still have 44 states where we can sell it. And during the non-summer months, you can sell it really without restriction. So those are really good things to have, but you still have those six states where we have to work through. And New York and California are by far the most important, given the size of their fuel marketplaces.
I've got a California question, but before that, I want to ask a little bit about, and Emily alluded to this in her keynote, and that was the idea that this RVP challenge that we're facing really was because at the time that the law was being written and the legislation was being done, it was maybe something we didn't anticipate the challenge that the RVP would be. Well, here we are. My question is, if we solve this RVP issue for E15, are we done then as we expand into even higher level blends, or is it another process when we go to E20, E25? Can you unpack that for me, whomever, Jeff?
Sure. I mean, we want the resolution on RVP to be transferable or applicable to other higher level blends. We don't want to have to go through this fight and this mess again when we're looking at E20 or E25 or E30 further down the road. I mean, the simplest solution to this would have been the legislation that was proposed last summer that would just say, you know, anything 10% and above gets the RVP waiver. Through a regulatory process, that's going to be a little trickier, but we certainly want this done in a way that doesn't hamstring us when we get to higher level blends.
To add on to that too, when you look at when Congress first did this, they took a rulemaking that EPA did. EPA did this rulemaking because they wanted to encourage ethanol usage. They did not do this to try and create an arbitrary regulatory cap. Congress then took that EPA rulemaking, made it law. Again, this was designed to encourage ethanol usage, and so the fact that this is, you know, a market cap, it was never designed to be that. So I think EPA is 100% justified in taking a look at how this is being implemented, how this is being utilized by them. This has never been designed to say, well, you can't sell ethanol during the summer.
Well, and from a scientific standpoint, volatility is the highest at 10%. So you start coming down that curve. I mean, the more ethanol you add, the less volatile the blend becomes, and so, you know, it makes sense from an environmental, you know, emissions standpoint as well, that these higher level blends would be afforded the same treatment as E10.
Got it. Here's the California question, and this is a good one, Jeff, and I thank you for giving it to me. The RFA has taken a pretty significant pivot relative to low carbon fuel standards, and in April, you testified at CARB that the RFA could support a low-carbon fuel program so long as it is done correctly and fairly. So first of all, I want to understand the motivations for that change,
sure,
and then maybe put some meat on the bone around correctly and fairly.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, you think back to 2008 when the Air Resources Board was adopting the LCFS in California. There were a lot of unknowns at that time, and you know, some fear of the unknown, I think, from our industry about what that program was going to mean, how it was going to affect our producers. You know, there was talk that it would effectively serve as a ban on corn ethanol at some point down the road. And so we, along with others in the industry, actually filed suit against the Air Resources Board. Had a long, drawn-out legal battle. Won in the district court. Supreme Court decided not to take the case. But during that whole time, as that was all playing out, the Air Resources Board made some badly needed adjustments to the program. They allowed producers to demonstrate on a kind of site-specific basis what their carbon intensity was rather than just taking a default value. And so, you know, really between 2010 and 2015, the program was vastly improved from just a nuts and bolts standpoint and really turned into a value driver for the ethanol industry. And right now, you know, when you have carbon credits out there selling for $170 a ton, that's adding pennies to every gallon of ethanol that's being shipped into that market. So, you know, we have, I'd say, have had a change in philosophy on the program. We are in a supportive posture today. We still have concerns and problems with how California is doing their program. The indirect land use change penalty.
I was going to ask about that.
That was really the source of the big fight 10 years ago is still a problem. There are other pieces of the regulation that we give us some heartburn. But overall, this has not been the real problem that we thought it was going to be for the ethanol industry. We've seen, in fact, record ethanol volumes consumed in California in recent years, and we expect that to continue. The other point I'll make real quickly is I think not only do we feel like we know CARB better today, they know our industry better. They've learned so much about the corn ethanol industry over the past 10 years because they're looking at petitions from all these facilities and understanding what's happening in terms of energy use efficiency and water use. And so there's just a better understanding between the two of us, and I think that gives us a good opportunity to work constructively moving forward.
If I could add to that, Tim, of the ACE ethanol producer members, two-thirds of them hold a pathway in California under the low carbon fuel standard. Obviously, for those of you that are from Nebraska, a lot of your product heads that way. Tom Bryan mentioned it this morning, and one of the purposes of the fuel ethanol workshop is to showcase the technology innovations, the products, the services that help you become more efficient as producers, and in turn, that helps you reduce your carbon footprint. And, you know, we may have philosophical differences of opinion over the broader debate over climate change or the role humans play or not in that, but the point Jeff made about how much money these credits are fetching today and the fact that so many of you have decided to apply for a pathway or you're already selling shows that this is the kind of program, a low carbon fuel standard, that can make economic sense as well. And that's great, and that's something we need to continue to leverage. A few tweaks to the GREET model, to the life cycle analysis, and frankly, as the curve gets steeper in California, CARB's probably going to have to make some changes to the life cycle modeling in order to allow more corn ethanol. It really could open up the marketplace for us, despite the fact, as John said, and maybe Jeff did too, that the state isn't allowing anything over E10 right now. But you know, you get a little more credit for the fact that nitrous oxide emissions aren't as bad as what GREET calls for. That will help open the door a bit. The international land use change numbers are quite a bit better than what California is crediting us for today. And then this is going to take more work, but there's an enormous amount of behind-the-scenes activity taking place to try and get these life cycle modelers, to try to get regulators like CARB to understand that not all crops contribute to carbon the same way. In other words, corn can help create more carbon in the soil than other crops, and shouldn't corn ethanol, therefore, get some credit for that? That's a big leap for some folks, but there's a lot of work taking place on that, and I think if we can make some of these updates and make some of these fixes, it will be a critically important market. And last point on this is the world is heading this way. The United States may not be there quite today, other than California and Oregon, but the entire globe is going to sort of frame up policy based on the ability to mitigate climate change. And we are part of the solution. And we need to embrace that, and we need to be involved in these discussions that lead to these programs.
Thanks for connecting the dots on California marketplace, their low carbon interests, and then yet there they are on the list of states that does not allow E15. It seems like there's an impasse there.
There is, but I think the LCFS, the only reason the Air Resources Board is now looking at E15 and kind of is getting curious and maybe more interested in that conversation is because of the LCFS. Corn ethanol has generated about half of the carbon reductions achieved under that program so far. That's a surprise to them, I think. But they're understanding, well, if we got that kind of carbon reduction with 10% ethanol, gee, we'd get another half as much with 15% ethanol. So as they look at the long-term durability of their program and the, you know, the increasing stringency of the curve, I think there's a growing recognition in California that allowing more ethanol in the blend would actually help the durability of that program, help contain costs on carbon credits. And so while the two things do seem at odds, I don't think they're entirely working at cross purposes. I do think the LCFS is helping open that conversation about E15 in California.
And then does it, by that same logic, Jeff, does it make sense then that the low carbon marketplace in California might be the first buyer for generation 1.5 ethanol, corn fiber, and are the corn ethanol or the ethanol that we manufacture with even lower carbon scores? Is that a fair?
Absolutely. There are pathways in California today for corn kernel fiber ethanol, and it has a 80% carbon intensity reduction versus gasoline. They're very excited about getting some of that product into the California marketplace. Very open and willing to work with producers who are using that technology. They want that product to come to California, and so they're very enthusiastic about it. In fact, more enthusiastic than EPA has been about corn kernel fiber and approving those technologies for these regulatory purposes.
Interesting. John, you talked about trade, and I want to pivot and talk a little bit about trade. Trump has a very, America First platform out there, and we understand, heard today in the keynote, Jeff, you talked about it yesterday, 10% of our production exported. Is our export situation sort of rock solid, or is there any risk in sort of we just had the G7 summit, didn't go so well between Trump and Trudeau, they're an important buyer of ours. Are we confident in the sort of health of the export marketplace under the Trump administration? Is there risk? Is there potential upside? Can you comment on that?
So I guess from my perspective on this, when I look at the economic model that we have that we can present to other countries and what we can provide them, that's very solid. What we can provide Canada, China, Brazil, we have a very economical, very competitive product we can provide them. These things are not really driven, though, on economics. When you look at the case of China, they have a stockpile of corn. They're trying to burn through it. They're trying to support potentially a domestic industry. They're going to put a tariff on us. When you look at the case of Brazil, they didn't like how we were taking some of the domestic space. There's some politics that got involved with one of the provinces down there. They slap a tariff on us. Now, we're still shipping a lot into Brazil. Canada still remains our largest market. There's a huge potential in China, but we have to pay attention to how these things are being positioned from a broader perspective. I can't say that we are at a 100% comfortable level in the strength and the availability of our export markets, and we need to make sure that we communicate how important it is to our industry and agriculture as a whole that we have open and available markets across the globe to put our products. And from our perspective, we have an excellent competitive product that we can ship around the globe, and we have some real big markets out there. You know, if you look at Brazil, you look at Canada, you look at China, historically, that's 3/4 of our exports. Now, you look at the EU, where we may potentially have an option to go back in there next year once their tariffs expire. That would be another marketplace where it would be great to access. So we need to pay attention to this rhetoric and this talk around trade, and these things will have an impact on the industry. What will not change, though, is the offering that we have and how competitive it is and how useful it is for other countries. We still will have that advantage, but we need to make sure that we are talking about how important it is to have open and available markets across the globe.
A good way to ruin our export market sort of bullishness is to attach a RIN on exports of ethanol. Exports have been a bright spot for us, absolutely. Brazil buying a lot of our product despite a TRQ. Canada being a reliable partner. I don't know, maybe Trump will get North Korea to buy ethanol when we lose the Canadian market. This is an interesting time we live in, right? But it's not rock solid. We see that from the kind of talk we have. Yes, exports were at a record pace last year, and every expectation is that they will exceed that this year. Thank goodness. But these trade talks and tariffs and threats and threats to threats and retaliation, this all has an impact on the marketplace, despite the fact, as John indicated, we are the low-cost molecule. If the sort of free market were allowed to work, U.S. ethanol would be the choice because, you know, you guys do it best. But these conversations about attaching RINs to exports or, the NAFTA renegotiation, these all have an impact. And we don't have answers for you today, but they all have an impact on whether that remains a bullish market outlet for us or not.
I've heard the RINs attached to exported gallons described as illegal. And this isn't just industry speak. This is something that is for sure black and white illegal, yet it's offered up. So can you guys sort that out for me? It is illegal.
Yeah. I think we've all had our trade council look at this proposal to attach RINs to exports or allow, I guess really the proposal is to allow exported gallons to count toward compliance with the RFS. It would absolutely be viewed as a trade distorting subsidy, because very simply, an exporter could lower the price of his exported ethanol by the value of the RIN. That would certainly be seen as, as